siamo in bocca? Che paura un po'. Have you ever at any time found a conflict between the Vedanta and homosexuality?
Oh my goodness. Well, I won't say there was a conflict. There wasn't a true conflict. But a great deal of my book, my new book, is about this. I mean, there would be really no ball game if it weren't my whole personality bumping individualistic edges against this extraordinary individual and kind of, as it were, testing him over and over again. To go into all the ins and outs of that would take longer than we have time for. Yeah, I'm quite sure, but that was, of course, my very first concern. I wasn't going near this man. If he was going to tell me I was a sinner, by God, all I need to go to the nearest Baptist to be told that. And I'm sorry to say, also, in many cases, the nearest rabbi, because they've been upholding the visitors with enthusiasm, basically. However, this man provided a completely satisfactory answer to my various problems without saying that I was as pure as driven snow. Nevertheless, he was extraordinarily broad-minded in the sense that as a monk he really lumped all sex, from the most legal heterosexual marriage to any other kind of sex, as a diversion from what to him was the one purpose of life, which is to seek God. Therefore, when you really came down to it, he would have liked every single person he met to become a monk or a nun on the spot. And he quite admitted that this was not practical, and he didn't demand it. He had a large congregation, a householder congregation, almost indistinguishable in appearance on Sunday morning from any kind of Christian congregation assembling for church, and the thing just the same, all except that the Hindus do not demand that ladies wear hats or any kind of head covering in church. But it was very respectable, as they say, the whole case is still to this day, and not freaky at all. We rather kept our Hinduism to ourselves in a way. I mean, many of the people who came to the lectures simply heard a kind of generalized type of philosophy, which was richly illustrated with Christian examples. Prabhavananda, among other things, wrote an entire analysis of the Sermon on the Mount from the point of view of a Hindu. He wrote a great deal about Jesus in accordance with one of the basic Vedantic propositions that all religions contain the truth, essentially, however much they may vary in outward form. He always had an icon of Jesus on the shrine, along with the figure of the Buddha and the pictures of Ramakrishna and his main disciples and various other Hindu deities, such as Krishna. And he saw no essential difference in any of this. It was just that he had a very, very much more permissive attitude to the don'ts and thou shalt not of Christianity. But then so do many Christians. My goodness, if I hadn't become a follower of his, I think I would have ended up as a Quaker. I found their religion magnificent. And I found that living with them, while extremely exhausting, because the first thing the Quakers do is give you a job, which lasts all day, forever. It's a total commitment.
He might have wound up as a chief.
Well, that's possible. I've never had any experiences with that. But, I'm sorry, I lost the thread of this answer, so let's get it.
There is another concept that might have come about as a result of Vedanta, and that is, well, one could have said this, because Vedanta teaches the necessity for detachment from all worldly desires and preoccupations and the elimination of self, it presents a conflict for the novelist who must draw on those very desires. And I think especially a novelist who is writing something close to autobiography.
Yes, but you see the critic as being rather, he's not quite watching his language there, because as a matter of fact, art implies detachment. Let's take the crudest example possible. A graphic artist is drawing a nude, as he just said. Now, according to his personal predilection, he probably, in many cases, finds the nude attractive. But he completely sublimates the attraction that he feels because he's getting on with the artwork. So as long as he's involved in the artwork, he is in fact doing just exactly that. I mean, he's rising above the desires. The doctor, in another way, does it, but of course there are many ifs and buts to that, because the doctor is after all not seeing the patient at his or her best, and probably only a very small area of the patient, which is surrounded with large forceps and unappetizing knots and such things as stitches. But art, you see, always, at the moment of art, you do in fact renounce.
Maybe the critic was talking about that being a deterrent to the accumulation of experience that we can then write about. Is that even possible?
Well, I never could imagine that anybody could lack experience to write about. I mean, I think that that in itself is a sort of a myth, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, it's very nice when you're young to say, yes, I must get more experience. If I don't get experience, all you really mean is you want to have more fun. You want to go around, oh, I must go to Iceland, I must go to Tierra del Fuego, I must do this or that, I must have a lot more affairs with everybody, because otherwise I won't know about life. But of course the actual truth is that the mouse in the prison cell knows about life. I mean, what we really fundamentally know about is consciousness. And when you see, a very good example of that, of course, is in some Oriental art, where people take one single seed, like the bamboo, and paint it over and over and over again. Never shall I forget going to say with Georgia O'Keeffe, the great artist, as you know, who lives near Santa Fe, a place called Abiquiu in New Mexico. I think we spent one evening about an hour and a half looking at these bamboo paintings that she had, Oriental bamboo paintings. And not one single one was absolutely alive. And when I got into the mood, which of course was highly induced by her, I really began to find this interesting. And then I understood how extraordinarily little material you need. The whole point is, can you get the perception open wide enough? That's all that matters.
In your introduction to Vedanta for Modern Man, you say that you believe that Vedanta is most likely to influence the West through the medium of scientific thought, and that eventually it will be relatively widespread. Certainly it has a solid and very comfortable foundation since Emerson backed it in this country. Do you think the proliferation in this country of religious groups with certain Eastern origins are evidence of influence by Vedanta?
Well, I think it is an absolutely inevitable thing that the impingement of the West on the East would produce a counter-movement. And indeed, very early in the proceedings, the British, just a very few of them, were taking the trouble to find out about Hinduism and so on. There were some foreigners who went to China and took the trouble to study. They went to Japan. It's just that with the interchange in which we keep giving techniques of all kinds to the East was giving forth its good to us, in a bad sense, in a good sense. Maybe this exchange has even almost stopped now. I mean, we're going on in kind of free fall. I don't know. But certainly that period has been gone through, no question. We're receiving an enormous amount of stimulation from the East. My goodness. I remember when I first came out here, you know, and I was, of course, very soon in the position of talking with college groups and so on, and meeting lots of students and people. How different things were. I can go on the, get up on a platform now. Sure, I'll be asked about being gay, I'll be asked about literature, what am I writing? But it always ends up with religion. There are always people who want to know. I was on the air, I think I was telling you already, just the other day, on Stonewall Day, 27th, people could call in to the station and call me directly on the air so that the people on the air could hear my replies. And in all the cases, the question asked was fundamentally religious. And in all the cases, I had to say, this is too complicated. I've only got 5 minutes. Will you call me at home later? And I told them how to get my number, and they did. But you see, it's extraordinary. That's something that's really happened since I've lived in this country. This enormous interest in the religious experience. And I don't mean by that I'm always running up against creeds and particular rituals or attitudes. On the contrary, I find that it's often not even necessary to discuss any of that. But they really want to know, look, whatever it is you do, does it work for you at all? You're an old man now, you're going to die, as they would say, charming frankly. Say, well, I'll tell you. And I say, well, I mean, you know, I'm certainly taken by the winds of life and couldn't hold myself up as a rock. But it does mean something, and furthermore, it's the only thing that means something, and that's it, as far as I'm concerned. And I said, and the other thing I say is, I believe that one can arrive at the truth. By the truth, I mean the truth oneself. I'm a good union. In all manner of different ways. And I would never say that I was particularly hated to meet a Hindu. I might have gotten involved with a Catholic priest. The only thing that was profoundly against my feeling was the idea of confessing and all that, because that never was my style. But I can imagine the individual was so much more important than the group that he belonged to, that I can imagine a way out Catholic creed. Just as in some respects you might well say that Sir Bernanda was a way out Hindu monk. You know, I mean, you have to have somebody who has a great deal of understanding. That you find in every denomination. I had a good deal of experience when I first came out here meeting all these kind of people whom I never knew before. I never met such people. I mean, I got to know lots and lots of Protestant denominations and fundamentalists. And one of the people who struck me most was a Seventh-day Adventist who, with all due respect to any who might be listening, did seem to me to hold beliefs which were, well, incredibly restrictive from my point of view. Nevertheless, this man was so evidently beyond all this into a realm of love for his fellow humans that he was one of the most remarkable people I've met since I've been out here. And I can't even remember his name anymore. I just met him for a couple of times. Such people you meet. You also meet people who have nothing whatever to do with religion. And people who say that they are atheists. That has nothing to do with it either. Because all of them are just the mantle.
Are you disappointed at all that this kind of influence has developed in so many cults? That's a terrible use word to use. I don't like to use the word.
Vivekananda said, he was one of Ramakrishna's chief disciples, as he says it now, that he wished there was a separate religion for every single person living on earth today. He thought one should be very individualistic about this.
This is a
very interesting observation that I often think of. I mean, really, you might say, following the idea of individualism, that my relation with Prabhupada, as described in my book, My Guru and His Disciple, is really the relationship is my religion. I mean, that's to say, what I was left with as a result of this relationship is all that I have. Because it's the only thing which is predicated entirely on my own observations. I mean, at least I know what he said to me. At least I know how he strikes me. And that was enough. And it wasn't for one moment that I felt he was the only person in creation who could have been like that. He was the only person I'd ever met who was like that. And therefore, he was my religion, and very individual as such.
Let's go back for just a minute. Mr. Norris began as a much larger book called The Lost, and that book never got written. Were Sally Bowles and Goodbye to Berlin attempts to complete that book?
Well, yes. I don't know if you've read an autobiographical book of mine, Christopher and His Kind. Well, there's a good deal about that problem in there, how I toyed with I give a whole description of how all these characters, you see, I was very much under the spell of Bulger, this kind of thing of writing some enormous work which sort of would take in the whole of human life, you know. And I had all these characters, all the people that I'd known in Berlin, were all waiting, as I put it, as though I were a refugee officer. In some place like Hong Kong, where these people are crowding in, you have to find a place for them. And you look in despair, because you cannot imagine how you're going to fit them all into the available housing. And this is exactly how I felt like when I started trying to write a novel about my Berlin life. And my first real tremendous breakthrough was when I decided that I wouldn't write a novel and attempt to have all of the Berlin characters in it together. Now, this sounds an absolutely idiotically simple decision to come to, but it tortured me. And finally, I thought, well, what do I really know best? What do I know backwards, forwards, and sideways? And I said to myself, the life of this man, Gerald Hamilton, who was called Mr. Norris. And that I could really write about. All right, I said to myself, we'll forget about everybody else. And I'll write that. Then I was tortured what to do with all the rest of the people. How can I arrange them? There ought to be a plot. So I made the most incredibly complicated plot. That's all detailed in Christopher and his time. And I thought I'll get them into the plot. Then, of course, they wouldn't stay in the plot. Then, as it were, another voice from heaven or Mount Sinai or somewhere spoke and said, why have a plot? These are like the most dazzling insights, these obvious remarks, you know, when the right person says it at the right time. A friend of mine, I was writing another book years later about my experience with the Quakers, and I wanted to put in absolutely all the refugees that I'd known when I was working with the Quakers, which was a class of at least 50 people. Suddenly one day one of my friends said, the refugees are a bore. And this again was like some dazzling insight. All the refugees were thrown out out of the book, which turned out to be my worst novel anyway, A Meeting by the River. What am I saying? The World in the Evening. Yes, one refugee is there, etc. But this is typical, you know, this extraordinary, you get into these jams, and then suddenly you see how to do it. Right now, I've got exactly the same situation ahead of me. I have these enormous diaries, you see, which I started keeping as soon as I got to this country, but I thought, now, you better, you know, keep your ears open and your eyes. So now the question is, all right, this book isn't so bad that I've just finished, because it keeps its point, pretty much, which is all about my relations to this monk. But now I have an enormous mass of sort of undigested material dealing with working in the movies and knowing an enormous number of people in showbiz, and also a considerable number of as they say, intellectuals, like Bertrand Russell, or of course Gerald Hurd, Aldous Huxley, and so on, who have partially appeared in other things that I've written already. But now, really, there's a great deal of material that I can't bear to part with, and I can't imagine what this book is going to be like. I think it's going to be a total mess. How I solved the problem of the book called Goodbye to Berlin was saying it isn't a book. It's a lot of bits. And we just put the bits together, and it'll be just as good as a connected novel, because it all takes place in the same area, and the reader will make up the joins for himself. And I've indeed found that again and again, that readers have sort of imagined they've read a coherent novel, where in fact they've read lots of little fragments about these people. But it all adds up because it's got an enclosing geographic area which holds it together, which is Berlin.
Want to put you in the picture?
Yeah, I'm
going to put you in the picture. I'm going to put you in the picture. Because this is what's going on.